The Football Show
on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch every live Premier League game this Christmas on Sky Sports, BT Sport, and Premier Sports.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
David Beckham and Qatar. Matt Slater has written a brilliant piece for The Athletic, well worth checking out, with Nick Miller. And he's looking at Beckham and Qatar and this very high profile deal which has been struck, certainly for 3 years, an option to extend to 10. And we're talking lots of money as well. Matt, great to have you on the show again. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. How are you?
Yeah, very well. You kicked off your piece with this very eye-catching and interesting juxtaposition of Lewis Hamilton and David Beckham high-fiving at the Qatar Grand Prix. They're in very different capacities and with very different messages.
Yes. I mean, it couldn't have been more stark, really. I mean, Lewis Hamilton was there wearing a rainbow helmet to signify his allyship with LGBT issues. He says he's going to wear it in Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia as well for the final two races of the season. He's become increasingly outspoken on a range of issues and has really, I think, sort of grown as a kind of spokesman for sort of, you know, various issues and more power to him. And I guess David Beckham has done that as well in the past and continues to do that in some places and in at some times. However, at that particular time, he was very nattily dressed, very, very conservative, very, very sort of businesslike, because, of course, he was there as, though no one's actually officially confirmed this, he was there as an ambassador for the Qatar World Cup. The two, you know, Lewis Hamilton and David Beckham, you know, get on. They've been together. They've been at events before, and you know, they were very, very warm. Their meeting on the grid, and it just seemed very, to me, sort of poignant, really, that Beckham, who has done so much in his career to speak up for women's rights, LGBT rights, as I've mentioned before, children's rights, you name it, right? A whole number of issues. And yet, you know, he was there very much sort of under a bit of a cloud, certainly back in the UK, where there's been an awful lot of writing about this very controversial deal that he's agreed to be an ambassador for a World Cup, but equally for a country that has baggage. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But it just seemed too good a photo, really, to ignore for an opening of a piece.
And Matt, the money that Beckham is receiving seems to be eye-catching in the extreme. 150 million over 10 years?
Well, there is a little bit of disagreement about the number. So I think this is interesting, though it doesn't necessarily change the, you know, how you'll feel about this story. But yes, 150 million was the number that was being really widely reported in the UK and has been obviously much discussed because it's huge, right? And it's also an awful lot of money to pay anyone to be an ambassador for a World Cup or even for sort of a larger project. I understand the number's not correct. And as we revealed in the piece, it's still a big number. You know, it's an awful lot of money. I think it's 12 million over 3 years, which gets us to about $50 million. If you sort of think of it. I wonder if there was a little bit of kind of Chinese whispers. I'll tell you one thing that is interesting, though, is that no one rushed to correct the number. And I just want to sort of leave that there as a sort of, you know, just plant that in people's minds, wondering why someone might not correct the number, particularly on the Beckham side. You know, if you're interested about, you know, how much you think you're worth. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was a very fair observation and an interesting one. Hey, look, if you want to tell us our house is worth X, we'll take it. You know, this is the brand. It's in a very healthy state. We'll come on to the finances, which are interesting as well, and maybe the links with Inter Miami. But to stick with the principle for a moment, you said it hasn't been officially announced. In so much as I can see, David Beckham himself has had nothing to say about the agreement. He's just there posing for photos in so much as he would as, you know, if he was advertising sunglasses.
You're absolutely right. So as far as I know, I haven't looked in the last couple of days. There's nothing on his website. There were those three Instagram posts that were really interesting. Because again, this is sort of what Qatar want to talk about, right? So the first one was him at a Jeff Koons the opening of an art exhibition. The second one was him on the grid. This was a huge weekend for them, by the way, you know, culture, sport. And then I think the third one was him at a sort of children's charity event. You know, it was sort of classic Beckham sort of picture. It was, you know, all powerful stuff. So that was it. That was the extent of his work. Now, I'm not seeing what's going on in the Arab world, so I don't know if there was more. I understand there wasn't at this stage. I think there's going to be more. But no, it was a very, very soft launch. He hasn't said anything. There's been no quotes. There's been no official press statement. Look, as I said, it's been widely reported. So people have spoken to his people and there have been briefings as to what it is and what it isn't. But there's been nothing formal. And certainly the Qataris haven't talked about it. You know, it's almost sort of like too hot to handle. Well, hold on, you know, why would you be embarrassed about hiring an ambassador? But anyway, that's what it is.
Yeah, like his PR team seemed to have responded to inquiries and, you know, includes phrases like David's always talked about the power of football as a force for good on many levels, you know, typically vacuous, really. I mean, you wonder how the World Cup has contributed in the various levels in Qatar. So you described it as a soft launch, which I think may well be correct in how they went about it strategically. It hasn't been received very well from what I can see across the board. I mean, people are fairly clued into what's going on here.
No. The reaction in the UK has been bad. There have been a sort of series of, well, proper two-footed challenges. I mean, there was one in particular in the Mail, Daily Mail. The coverage of this has been negative. And the comments on social media, the reaction to my piece, which I desperately tried to be balanced and fair, and I spoke to people close to him at length. The public are seeing this negatively. They are saying, you know, he's a hypocrite given his stances on previous issues. They have pointed out that, hold on, I thought you were an ambassador for the England World Cup bid where we were kind of humiliated in 2010 and now you're representing this lot. And look, as I mentioned in my very first answer, Qatar comes with baggage, like very, very, very obvious baggage that keeps coming. And if you're going to do this, if you're going to sort of, you know, be an ambassador, he's not the only one, there's loads of them, right? You have to be ready to answer these questions. You have to absolutely know your stuff. Do you know your stuff? Have you done your due diligence? And I think that's interesting. And then are you ready for the tough questions? Are you able, you know, if you feel that about football, and to be fair, I think you could argue that David Beckham has been consistent in that he does believe in the power of sport. He does believe engagement. You know, he went to play for PSG. He has known Qataris, senior Qataris for a while. You know, he has chosen to be a UNICEF ambassador and travel the world. So I think we have to acknowledge that here is a guy who genuinely believes that he can do something with his platform. And he genuinely believes that sport is a good thing and that football in particular is a good thing. And it can engage people. It can break down barriers. It can help. Now, we can be as cynical as we want. We can ask questions and say, really, can you prove that? And can you explain to me what's actually changed in 10 years? We can do all of that. And I think David Beckham has to be ready to answer those questions. At the moment, he hasn't made himself available. I think they will come. And I sort of kind of worry for him. I don't want to sound sort of too paternal about it. But, you know, if he does appear before a press conference, I could tell you right now, there'd be people with their hands up in the air getting ready to ask him questions about migrant deaths.
And that's the thing. So the migrant death situation has been, I would say, widely reported on for, is it coming up on a decade now? We've seen horrific...
December 2010 when they won the bid.
Images coming through and horrific reports from various outlets, which, you know, you struggle to believe, really. And then it's been well documented, I think, at this stage, the LGBTQ mm-hmm. community is criminalized in Qatar. It is illegal to be gay. Human Rights Watch contributor to your piece as well made the point there are no women's rights. They have a male guardianship system, very akin to Saudi Arabia, meaning women have to obtain permission from their male relatives to do things like marry, study abroad, take certain jobs, etc. As somebody made the, maybe it's a less eye-catching point, but there are no unions. When Beckham was a player, he was very much part of a global player union. Freedom of the press, and we've seen journalists arrested very recently. And that's not to get into the nitty-gritty of the kafala system, which goes beyond just the World Cup infrastructure. Mm. So when we talk it's about baggage, that is quite the euphemism. I mean, I look forward to this press conference if he even dares to say to the press, hit me with your questions.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a long list. I'm not paid by Qatar. No one's asked me. I've asked the questions. I've been covering the story for a decade. Look, they're not on this call. So what I would say is they have made progress. They said they would. We've asked them questions repeatedly about it. Has it been quick enough? Have they delivered on time? Is there still a lot to do? Yeah, all of that. If you work on a building site controlled by the Supreme Committee, the organizing committee of the World Cup, life's not bad. I'm not sure I'd want to do it, but you know, we get into sort of kind of really sort of philosophical issues there and just how lucky we are to be born in the West, frankly. Mm. And also we have to remember how far we've come and the way we built canals and railways and all of our infrastructure. So we have to be very careful that we're not constantly, you know, well, being hypocrites, basically, frankly. Mm. Now, all that said, and I should also probably make the point that Qatar, there are different countries, right, with different customs, different cultures. We have to sort of, you know, at least acknowledge that and, you know, recognize it and sort of, you know, understand that, you know, we haven't got all the right answers. So all of that said, I think it's migrant deaths of all the things that is the hardest one for Qatar to swerve, because whilst it's completely legitimate for a country to have a plan about diversifying its economy, using its money to help its people, to grow as a nation, it's perfectly legitimate. And Qatar and all the countries in that area have these plans. And it's perfectly, again, legitimate to use major events. We do it as a catalyst, as a means to project soft power as well, all those things, perfectly legitimate. But they chose to bid for a World Cup. Now, they also were choosing to bid for Olympics, and they weren't really even getting on the starting line because the IOC just didn't think they'd be ready for it. They just didn't see how they could do it. FIFA didn't. FIFA let them onto the starting line, and you know, and then they won that contest, which is an entirely different show. But they won that contest. Now, by making that choice, they were saying we're going to accelerate what we want to do with hotels and a new port and a new airport and new roads. We're going to massively accelerate it. And that means in a country of 300,000 people, we're going to need an awful lot more help. Send me your poor, because we are going to, we've now accelerated our timeline. And as a country, they weren't ready. They're still not really ready. They weren't ready culturally. They weren't ready just in terms of basic infrastructure. Where do we put these people? How do we look after these people? How do we pay these people? Do we have to? Is our legal system up to scratch? No, none of these things were ready, and these people, unfortunately, have paid. Some of these people, anyway, have paid the ultimate price for this kind of experiment, this accelerated national plan for relevance, for you name it. That's an impossible one for me, for Qatar's clever, nice, charming PR people to justify.
Mm. Like, I think you make a lot of very fair points, and it's worth, like, I would agree, it's very, very dangerous territory for us to sit here as if we're all unblemished and every jurisdiction in this part of the world can look proudly at their various actions and decry others. So I think that's a very fair point to make. I think it's a fair point as well to point out politicians have the capacity to exercise real change. Look at political relations with a country like Saudi Arabia currently. And there are, you know, the FIFA point is well made as well. And yet it's just so striking that David Beckham, who I think we can conservatively say is financially okay and his earning power is okay, that he has inserted himself into this mess. And somebody as well who's so brand conscious. That's what's so staggering about this. I mean, I wonder, when you were sounding out the Beckham camp, are they in any way queasy about how difficult this one is to square? I mean, are they half saying, yeah, look, I know, but it's just, look, it's the deal and it's where we are. I mean, that's what's so striking about this, that this must be one of the most brand conscious sports people there's ever been. And here he is, the poster boy for this.
Yeah. Well, look, you're asking all the questions that when I heard and read about this, that's what I immediately went to. You know, why? Does it? What's he doing? There's so many things that he is doing already. You know, into Miami, he's got so many still endorsements. He was very involved in China a few years ago. He still has quite a few big contracts there. One with a big gambling firm, Las Vegas Sands, who are obviously based in the States, but have massive gambling interests in Macau and Singapore and elsewhere. You know, he was, you know, as I said, in the whole China boom story of a few years ago, you know, Beckham was an early adopter. He was out there shaking hands back then. And, you know, I've mentioned his UNICEF work a few times. You know, he's a high profile guy. He's got enough on his plate, right? Inter Miami is his big passion at the moment, as far as I can tell. And yet he's chosen to take this on. He's chosen to take this thing that we've spent 10 minutes kind of listing all the reasons why someone who's really brand conscious would be thinking, I don't want to answer questions about any of that stuff. Mm. Now, look, just we have to at least acknowledge the possibility that he knows all this. He's sat down with his experts, with his representatives, with his team, and gone, do you know what? I hear you, but I think the Qatar World Cup is an amazing opportunity to... It's the first World Cup in a Muslim country. It's the first World Cup going to that part of the world. I think it can do good. I think we can learn a little bit about each other. I think Qatar has chosen to bring this scrutiny upon themselves. So they clearly want to learn something. It's possible that he sincerely thinks all of those things. We have to at least admit that that is possible, that he feels exactly the same way about that list and is saying, do you know what? Is it better that I just ignore Qatar and Saudi and Abu Dhabi and the rest of them? Just ignore them and pretend they don't exist because they are so alien to me and what I believe. You know, their culture is so far removed from mine. I just don't really want to go there. Or do I go there and talk to them? And
what? Because that's the and talk to them and like and what? What is David Beckham going to say to them? Here's a quote from. Somebody in your piece, and I thought it was well put. The labour of the 2 million migrant workers is supporting Beckham's contract. That's a very direct link. How would David Beckham feel if he signs a contract with Qatar, if they took his passport, paid him later, not at all, and if he attempts to complain about it, they threaten to put him in jail and not contact his family? That's the experience of a lot of workers in Qatar. So that point, the labour of the 2 million migrant workers is supporting Beckham's contract. I mean, that's stark. The whole, you know, let's engage and let's talk just falls down when Beckham's in, what talk are you imagining that's happening here at the Qatar Grand Prix?
I wouldn't do it for 150 million. I really wouldn't. Mm. But people do. I know people who do. They're not maybe doing it in such high profile roles as David Beckham, but there's an army of white collar people working in all kinds of roles in all those places.
And you know, to an extent, and this is where, like, because none of us want to get on too high a horse in life. Again, I emphasize that point because in some respects or in certain situations, we would all have our price because you have to put food on the table. So, you know, there's an aspect to life as well that is grubby, unfortunately. But I just don't have David Beckham in that category, you know, for money. You know, that's what I don't understand. Although you do, and it's a brilliant piece and it's a long piece, you do make some very interesting points towards the end about the Beckham finances and Inter Miami in particular, and maybe Qatar links there. So, you know, there's more at play than just a handy few million in the bank and off I go.
Sure. Well, I can do those quickly if you like, because, you know, we're wondering why. Why would this guy, who a few years ago we found out really, really wants a knighthood and really wants to be loved. Mm. We all want to be loved a little bit. I could take a leave of knighthood, but we all want to be loved, right? And respected.
Yeah.
Very important to him. Fine. he's taken this very controversial role on. So why? What's really going on here? So one thing is, does he need the money? So I spent a little bit of time looking at the finances of his company. He is an industry. He and his wife are an industry, and it's a complicated thing. I don't want to spend too long on it. To me, it looks like they're doing fine. They're a complicated duo in that the narrative for a long, long time was he was just this amazing poster boy, good-looking guy, could sort of, you know, throw any old clothes on him and he'll flog it, watch his sunglasses, the lot. And he still does a lot of that. Now, that runs out, though, doesn't it? You have a shelf life and everyone, even the best-looking guy, best-looking person, you can't do that forever. And there is, I think, a sign that that's already happening, but he's actually now becoming a bit more of an investor. In the last few years, he's actually becoming more of an active investor. So a range of stuff, you know, electric cars, CBD, you know, cannabis stuff, legal, or a range of things, a production company making documentaries. Interesting. You know, some of them will come off, some of them won't. Fine. This is what you do. If you have money, you do something else with it. But the narrative was always that Victoria Beckham, Posh Spice, of course, very into fashion. It was sort of a bit of a kind of vanity project, and Beckham was kind of funding her, and that's been true. You know, there's large sums of money that go from sort of the David Beckham side of the business to the Victoria Beckham side of the business, which has been loss making for a very long time. What I've seen since writing the piece, I've learned a bit more that Victoria Beckham's actually quite close to making it. You know, genuinely, she's actually got quite good at it. I'm wearing a bloody hoodie, so what do I know about fashion? But she's in all the right shops. She goes to all the right places. She's learned the hard way. She's got good people around her. And while she's not quite cracked it yet, she's getting pretty close. And her business is the sort of business that will be bought by someone big and will do boom and will do well. So that long kind of flow of money from David Beckham to Victoria Beckham could well be reversed. Now, the short answer here is I don't think he needs the money. It's not like they're running out of cash. They've lost a couple of contracts. They lost some of these Chinese contracts. They had to sort of unwind a business with it's all a bit complicated. They had to unwind a business with a couple of Chinese billionaires. They also had to buy out a former partner, Simon Fuller, who did Pop Idol, his first business partner. So a couple of things that are complicated around his businesses. But by and large, he's okay. Now, I think the more interesting angle is Inter Miami. Inter Miami is his big thing. It's been his big. It's what he's spending a lot of time doing. It's not going very well. You know, you can look it up yourself. They've already breached the rules for the salary cap. They haven't succeeded. They've run 2 years now, and they've been pretty hopeless on the pitch. Crucially, they are not playing in Miami. They're playing in Fort Lauderdale up the road. They badly need to get downtown. That's the only way they're ever going to make money. So he needs a big injection of cash. He's been talking to the Qataris about that for years. He finished his career at PSG. There's a Qataris quite like Miami. There's a sort of, you know, long-standing strategic link, interest in the place. Qatar for the World Cup, they love Americans because Americans, believe it or not, they always figure really, really highly on ticket sales for World Cups because of the huge expat population, even whether USA are there or not. I think USA was second at Russia 2018 in terms of ticket sales. So it's very important for the Qatar 2022 project that they're in America. They've just opened Qatar Airways have just opened a route between Doha and Miami. So look, there are things at play, and Qatar Airways were an original idea to be on the shirt of Inter Miami. They went a different way. So I think, and various sources have told me this, that at some point that link is going to become a lot closer and more obvious. I think that's what this deal is the beginning of.
Okay. And Matt Slater of The Athletic. The piece is great. It's really detailed, really balanced, really fair, and well worth a read. Thanks so much for your time as ever, Matt. Appreciate it.
No worries. Take care.
Cheers.
Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent is with us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Joe. How are things?
Yeah, very well. I've just been talking to Matt Slater of The Athletic. Wrote a very interesting piece on David Beckham and his 10-year partnership with Qatar. Do you believe that Beckham is hoping to engage with the Qataris and bring about meaningful change?
Well, I didn't get to hear the piece, Joe, so I'm actually I might need to listen back to sort of find a firm opinion on it. But it doesn't sound great as you've pitched it there, to be honest. I would have to take a slightly skeptical approach to your stance on that and suggest that maybe Brand Beckham, maybe is this what they need to do to get England the World Cup at some stage in the future? Or I don't know, is this what they need to do? Wasn't he the ambassador for 2022, or am I mistaken?
He was there. For 18, certainly one of them anyway.
Do you know, as the saying goes, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe that's the way to go with it.
Have you seen much of the football this evening?
I'm not going to lie, Joe, I haven't. I saw Liverpool's first 20 minutes or so where they were tearing Everton apart, and it looked like it was going to be any number. But it's been a busy 24, 48 hours, and that took over, so I haven't seen as much since.
No, but that's okay.
Yeah, honest answer.
Everton have steadied the ship since, so 64 minutes on the clock, and they're 2-1 down, although Mo Salah is bearing down in goal. Seamus Coleman is scampering after him, but not quickly enough. Mo Salah's finished brilliantly, under huge pressure from Seamus Coleman. You so often see strikers make a mess of those one-on-ones when they're being chased down. Salah finished brilliantly. I think, and we'll get a replay in a second, I think Coleman miscontrolled the ball on halfway in a not dissimilar way to Jorginho. Not as glaring. I only caught it out of the corner of my eye. There are a couple of Everton players walking over to Seamus Coleman and giving him a ruffle of the head and don't worry about it kind of a touch. I'm just watching Salah celebrate, so we'll get the replay any second. So that's Everton 1.
Did you see the Bernardo Silva goal, Joe?
No.
Did you see Bernardo? Yeah, that is the moment. I did see that, all right. You'll be seeing that's the moment. The Everton replay is just out of sight for me here, so you can describe that. But wow. Bernardo Silva scored a stunning side foot volley for Man City. It was a great team move, but one of these balls into the area that he met just perfectly on the run with a side foot volley into the top corner. It's a great goal. Genuinely a great goal. So everyone will have... we'll be seeing it very soon if they haven't already.
Yeah, very satisfying sounding goal, Dan. Yeah, this was Everton corner. Ball is cleared and it falls to an Everton player who knocks it back to Seamus Coleman halfway. And Coleman, the ball was bouncing up maybe around hip height, and Coleman made a bit of a mess of it by his standards. And suddenly Salah was in on goal, and it's two hands to the head for Seamus Coleman now as he walks back to halfway. So Everton 1, Liverpool 3, 65 minutes on the clock. The clock is going to come against us here very, very quickly. So let's get straight down to it. Stephen O'Donnell, this looks to be happening to Dundalk, Dan.
Yeah, I suppose we spoke, was it, on Monday? And it just goes to show, like, football is sort of manic, really, sometimes. There was an FAI Cup final on Sunday. I recorded the game. I generally record most of the games that I sort of go to try and watch them, and haven't really been able to get back through it. But I did sort of earlier on get to look back at some of the scenes after the match, and it almost like feels out of date already, you know, with everything that's happened subsequently. You know, Stephen O'Donnell going around to St Patrick's Athletic players, but yeah, no, we did speak about it on Monday.
You felt it was on then.
Yeah, no, I would have reported it, obviously, in Monday morning's paper that he was the number one target. And, this one has got very fraught. Like, St. Pat's are definitely not happy with Stephen O'Donnell at all. There's a sort of a dispute around, what were the terms of his deal at St. Patrick's Athletic, you know, and that's going to have to play itself out. And they're unhappy. They believe... that he wasn't, you know, that there is something that ties him there for the next 2 years. I don't think Stephen O'Donnell would have been pursuing, you know, would have been considering options elsewhere if he didn't believe that it would be free to go. So, like, we'll see. There'll probably have to be discussions there to resolve that. But in terms of the general concept, I did feel it was possible. And I think, you know, Stephen O'Donnell has a strong relationship with Dundalk. And I certainly would be aware that the owners of Dundalk, the new owners, have ambitious plans that I think would be attractive to people. So it's a surprise to some people, certainly. And it's generated great debate in sort of, you know, in sort of Irish football world. You know, is it the right thing to do or not? But Pats aren't happy. And as a result, it might take a little bit of time just for this to be... I suppose it all to be formalised and to be announced and stuff. And as I said, it has the potential to be a bit fraught in the intervening period. But, I mean, Pats have gone on and appointed someone else subsequently. So, I mean, everyone's moving on in terms of planning to some degree, but it may just be the O'Donnell to Dundalk one that takes the longest to just actually get sort of put down in stone, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I saw you reporting earlier on in the Irish Independent that the Drogheda manager, Tim Clancy, making his way towards Richmond Park, we think. Is this a good move for Stephen O'Donnell? Is this a logical move for Stephen O'Donnell? Will he have funds Dundalk or off the back of a troubled period, I think it's fair to say?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they I've spoken about it on the show before. Yeah. I think people are broadly aware of it, that, you know, they actually did spend a lot of money this year. They just spent it really badly. And it's been taken over by new owners, local owners. And the interesting angle to the ownership thing is there's one half of the ownership is the Andy Connolly, one of the former owners, and his sort of company, his sort of side of the thing. You know, there's a family connection there. And then the other side is this company, StatSports, who are like a global tech firm who's, you know, who are actually, their origins is Dundalk. They're based in the area, but they're a sort of a worldwide company doing extremely well. Their involvement is significant. And I think, you know, Dundalk, on the face of it, people on the paper are looking at it and thinking, well, you know, why would you leave a team that came second and won the FAI Cup to go to a team that looks like it's been a bit of a basket case? But I don't think they're going to be a basket case under this ownership at all. And I think, you know, in terms of a project for the coming years, I think it's going to be a pretty interesting one. And as a result, I think there was probably a lot of managers out there eyeing it up. But I think, you know, the Stephen O'Donnell was the one that they wanted, and he wants to go there. So it's going to be a lot of pressure on him. You know, it's going to be very interesting to watch how it all plays out, because Dundalk has still had success in recent years, so there will be expectation with that. But I think he's not going to have to deal, to be fair, with probably some of the difficulties that recent managers there have had to deal with. You know, I think it's going to be a much more stable, organised operation. And I think they have the potential. Next year might be a little bit more of a consolidation year and a small bit more of a stable things, you know, to stabilise things. But I think in the years that follow, I'd expect them to be up there challenging for stuff again, yeah.
To matters international then, I want to ask you about the game at Tala Stadium last night. First of all, though, on Stephen Kenny's situation, there was a board meeting on Monday. This was much flagged in advance. And in the end, we got a statement to say not a huge amount. So where are we in all that?
Yeah, in fairness, it's been kept pretty tight. And there's no point in
you're telling me that Dan McDonnell...
It's saying otherwise.
The Dan McDonnell trusted sources... I've gone cold. You know, meeting them in car parks and getting the word. No.
Yeah, like I mean, I just had to go back to plan A and start rooting through some bins again. You know, like that's just what you have to do. You know, it's just get out your trusted gloves and go for it. You know, I think it's a conscious thing to try and make this process, I suppose, noise free as much as is possible. But what I would say is, like, around it, you know, I don't feel any sense of crisis or panic in the air, you know, that there's something mad coming. Like, to be fair, there was a lot of stock placed in this board meeting from a long way off, and that actually was driven by the FAI themselves initially in statements that they made. But in recent weeks, I would have reported, and certainly other people, would have been a general sense that they weren't going to have this meeting on the 29th and come out and say, well, here's what we've decided to do. They always had to go back to Stephen Kenny to discuss, you know, he wasn't, there was definitely no negotiating taking place, you know, before the meeting with Stephen Kenny. So that had to happen. And maybe, listen, people have conflicting information, conflicting beliefs about what might happen. From what I have been able to manage to glean, I don't think, you know, I don't think I'll be reviewing my prediction right. or reviewing my sort of statement that he'll get a contract for the Euros campaign. I think that it's just a matter of maybe what the terms and conditions of it might be in a scenario where they suddenly decide to change things up. You know, you don't want to be left exposed to, say, full pay or something like that. But I think broadly he's going to get his Euros contract. Yes, I do.
11-0 at Tallaght Stadium last night. Record margin for the Irish women's team. Denise O'Sullivan, awesome, playing much closer to goal. Katie McCabe, every time the ball went near her, she was a huge threat and causing problems. She also scored two, and we had two own goals. And then we had Kyra Carusa, Lucy Quinn, Saoirse Noonan, Amber Barrett all on the score sheet as well. I mean, there was an interesting point, I thought, made by Vera Powell after the game. So you might have seen that the English national team were 20-0 winners against Latvia. Ireland, obviously, 11-0 winners. Northern Ireland beat North Macedonia 9-0. Switzerland beat Lithuania 7-0. Spain played Scotland and they won 8-0. Luxembourg, we know all about Luxembourg these days, Dan. They were 9-0 winners against Austria. So there's some hefty scorelines. And Vera Powell made the point. She said she's been talking about this before, that this has been coming because of a few decisions that have been taken to create more and more opportunities for the best teams, and that's fantastic. But nobody is there to care for second tier and lower tier teams, and you can already see the results of it. UEFA really needs to think about it. I've offered my help because I've been thinking about these things for many years now. The English coach as well was saying that, look, great to win and everything, but we have to really help develop countries. It's just such a striking set of scorelines. You just do not want that two-tier status to embed in the game because it's not good for the game.
No, and it's almost like a Rugby World Cup or something. It's almost like professionals and amateurs in some cases, you know. And like I sort of have to be consistent on this because I think, you know, when England hammer San Marino or Andorra, whoever they played recently, and people say, oh, there should be pre-qualifying for these nations. And I think, no, international football is about getting the chance to represent your country, and you should get the chance to play against the big teams. But clearly it's not just two or three teams that are getting these drubbings. They're being handed out everywhere, you know, and it is a rubbish spectacle, really. Mm. Like, you know, 19-20-0 is like, that's an embarrassment, you know. So it's a very difficult one. And like, you know, I think in terms of women's football generally, like, it is at that crossroads. And maybe rugby is a parallel in some ways where, like, some countries professionalise and some don't. And the danger is that a situation sort of is cemented, that it's very hard for you to get back from it. Now, I know that, like, associations, and I know that, by the way, some of these teams, they're not saying they're amateurs. Like, that's not the case in some of them.
Yeah.
But clearly, there's something that has to be done by the parent associations in these countries too. Are they embarrassed about losing these scores, or do they even take their national team seriously? That is probably a relevant point as well.
I think that is the point being made almost.
Yeah.
Dan McDonnell of the Irish Independent. Sorry, a bit shorter and sweeter than usual this evening, Dan, but thanks so much. Appreciate it.
It wasn't sweet, Joe. I'll talk to you.
Mark Lawrence, an evening hello.
Hello.
We mentioned you were coming on. Frank has texted in. I know Laura knows his movies. Thoughts, please, on the new Bond. I would say, says Frank, long, dull, overly episodic. And did I mention long and dull? Doesn't sound like Frank needs your opinion, but go on.
I enjoyed it. I wouldn't be the biggest Bond fan, but my better half dragged me along. And we sat in one of those where you could have a drink and stuff like that, watching the film and a burger, so I enjoyed it and I stayed awake, so that must be good because it felt like about 3 hours.
I mean, it definitely goes on. Are you a Succession man?
Listen, absolutely, but I've just got to the latest episode, which I saw, last night.
Careful.
Well, no, I'm not going to give anything away, but I'm just going to say generally it's all got a little bit samey.
Yeah.
I love the acting. I think it's fabulous, and I love the actors and the actresses, but I just think it's got a little bit samey.
Yeah, I think that's a common refrain at the moment on this series. So, busy night in the Premier League. I will give team news and go through the games in just a moment, but can we just mention Ray Kennedy, who I'm sure you're keen to mention as well? We'll start on Ray, the player, in a second. I was just saying to the lads at the start of the show, I hadn't realised that Ray Kennedy had been diagnosed with Parkinson's in his early 30s, that it had been that long. That is just an extraordinary burden to live with for that long.
Amazing. And I must flag up the the PFA, the Professional Football Association in the UK, who did a lot of work in his house for him in terms of, you know, because he was in a wheelchair and stuff like that, and lowered lots of stuff and put ramps in and all kinds of things like that. Jimmy Case was his big mate. Jimmy would have been a regular visitor with him. They spent a lot of time obviously playing together, but also going out together. There were two boys out on the town. And the great thing about him, and one of the many great things about Ray, was the fact that, you know, he came from a very successful team at Arsenal. They won the double, didn't he? And he was a rough, tough centre forward in those days. Scored a lot of goals, difficult to play against, held the ball up well. And when he got to Liverpool, Bob Paisley played him on the left-hand side of midfield. And everybody said, well, what are you doing? Oh, my God, he was, like, fantastic, especially in Europe, more so in Europe. He's still a top player, but more so in Europe because he never gave the ball away. He held the position brilliantly, understood it, the defensive side, and then he'd come in from the left with balls getting crossed in from the right, and he'd be jumping up against, he was about 6'1", jumping up against a 5'8" fullback, and he used to batter him out of the way, score lots of goals. And just, he was a real class act, but he also as well enjoyed his life.
Yeah, because I saw Paisley said, in my view, one of Liverpool's greatest players, probably the most underrated.
Yes. Yeah, most definitely. The season I signed, 81-82, he was going to Swansea with John Toshack, who'd taken over there. I think Ian Callaghan went, I think Tommy Smith went as well, and I played about 4 or 5 games with him. It might actually have been more, I'm not sure, but I do remember in one game in the League Cup, and nothing really was happening, and he was due any day to go to Swansea. He got tackled by a Welsh international playing for Arsenal in midfield called Peter Nicholas, and it was a little bit late, and basically Ray just hit him with a left hook and knocked him down. The referee obviously came over to send him off. He said, Ray, I've got to send you off. And Ray said, I'm not particularly bothered. I'm signing for Swansea tomorrow and I don't really want to get injured. And just off he went, which was, at the time, we're all like, what? But when you think about it now, it was actually quite funny.
So in the Guardian obituary, they said, when he was formally diagnosed in late 1984, Kennedy was finally able to account for some of the physical difficulties he had quietly noticed, even back in his days at Arsenal, where he sometimes had trouble doing up shirt buttons and occasionally suffered from excessive post-match fatigue, which puts his achievements into even starker. Oh, yeah. Like, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, I mean, right, so digest that. Look at everything that he won. I mean, absolutely amazing. And I mean, I don't know, but I mean, he wasn't the quickest, but even so, with that kind of revelation, I mean, I knew nothing about that whatsoever, and I'm pretty sure most of the boys who played with him would not have known anything about that either. So his achievements really are quite phenomenal. Yeah.
That's good to hear that the PFA did get involved and help out, because he did have to sell his medals and his England caps in the early 90s.
Yeah, well, even though, you know, playing for Liverpool in that particular era, you probably won't remember, you probably weren't even born, but tax, if you went over a certain number tax wise, it was, you paid 83 pence in the pound, so you got 17p out of every quid that you earned, and it was ridiculous. And it wasn't until Maggie Thatcher came in the mid 80s, I think, where the highest tax rate could be 60%. At least that was an improvement. So, you know, he wouldn't have earned fortunes from the game. Yeah. Quite simply, that's exactly the way that it was. And obviously, he had to obviously keep going. And PFA were great with him. As I say, Jimmy Case was fabulous with him. And I know Jimmy was at Brighton. And he was travelling up to, I think he lived up Hartlepool way, Ray Kennedy. So Jimmy Case needs a massive pat on the back for what he did for his mate.
Okay. Well, we'll turn to the football this evening then. So, early scores, and we're in the first 10 minutes of all of these games. Southampton already 1-0 up against Leicester. It's nil all between Watford and Chelsea. Lukaku still in cotton wool and on the bench. Kai Havertz is leading the line. So, nil all there, Watford-Chelsea. West Ham have taken an early lead against Brighton, 1-0 there. And it's nil all between Wolves and Burnley. Manchester City away to Aston Villa. As much as Pep Guardiola is saying there's an emergency of players, they still have Sterling, Mahrez, Jesus as their front three, Bernardo Silva, Rodri, Fernandinho in midfield. And then, of course, at Goodison is the Merseyside derby. Here is a clip of Jurgen Klopp. He was talking on Match of the Day in advance of this game. Not his favourite game of the season.
It's always a completely different game. So I really very often don't like the intensity of the game. It's too much for me. It's, I like physical football. I have no problem with that. We play that. Other teams play that. But in that game, very often people put too much in. So I can say it's not my favourite game of the year, to be honest, because of that.
Led to a slew of all sorts of headlines, and he didn't like them. He was asked about follow-up questions about all this in his press conference yesterday.
No, because we are all not able to write it in a proper way. Nothing else to say about it. I said what I said, and that's it. And from now on, from that moment on, I prepared as a normal football game.
So that's Klopp the last few days. Teams are in. Shane Pennington is at Goodison.
Everton boss Rafa Benitez makes two changes from the side beaten at Brentford last time out. Richarlison and Damari Gray both come in to start. They replace Alex Iwobi and Anthony Gordon. Whilst for Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp makes just one change from the side that beat Southampton on Saturday. Joel Matip comes in to start. He replaces Ibrahima Konate. At Goodison Park, it's Everton and Liverpool.
Kicks off at 8:15. Mark Lawrenson with us. So Everton, 5 defeats in 6. We'll get on to Liverpool, but what's gone so badly awry at Everton here? 5 defeats in 6 is a lot.
Yeah, well, the new signings came in and they were great, weren't they, at first? Gray and who's the other lad they signed? Townsend, obviously, and they kind of lit up the league, in all honesty, in the first half a dozen games. But, I mean, the reason that those players came in because of this financial fair play, so... In fairness to Rafa, he's doing the job with his hands tied behind his back. No Calvin Lewis. Richarlison's missed quite a few games as well. And I think just look at them defensively, and they're a little bit slow at the back, and they've obviously been found out for that as well. And I know, you know, people are saying, oh, if Everton get beat tonight, Benitez will go and he's favourite and all that kind of thing. But who are they going to get to come in, and how is he going to deal with the FFP? It's almost impossible. So I think Liverpool will win. I'm with Jurgen. The horrible game, Joe. The horrible games to play, because you can only win. Seriously, half the time in our era as well, there was hardly any football played, and it was just a pain in the butt to play in the games, unless you won, of course, and then it was fabulous. But in terms of looking forward to it, I never look forward to it. As in a game, I look forward to it as the occasion and the noise, but the rest of it, honestly, it was like, oh, here we go, and it does, and people always say this, and it is really, really true. It doesn't matter where you are in the league, because of the intensity, because of the aggression, you know, because of the way that sometimes, you know, both teams try to referee, etc. It's just not an enjoyable game at all.
Even today, even in modern football.
Yeah, well, I think even today. Well, Jurgen's obviously, when he said something there, that's obviously about Van Dijk's injury and all those kind of. I think that's his big worry, that players can get injured, and obviously he knows by his own cost, and that was the case. Football's a little bit better because obviously you can't snap people in two like it used to happen, but is it that much better? When was the last time we really saw an outstanding end-to-end game of football between Liverpool and Everton, whether it's at Anfield or at Goodison?
Yeah, true. So Richarlison's back in, Decore's back in, so they're starting to get a few back. You're obviously around Merseyside. Did the Everton fans really struggle to warm to Rafa, or is that stuff overblown?
Listen, it's a classic case. Lots of them didn't want him. Then they saw the first half and a dozen games and thought, oh, he's great. And now, of course, they don't want him now.
Okay.
But I think anybody with a modicum of common sense will look at what he's had to deal with and just say, well, what do people expect? And what? Well, we know what they want. They want to be in the Champions League. But, you know, what do people expect him to do? He's not a magician.
And to be fair to him, the brand of football, I mean, I was never much of a fan of Rafa's Liverpool, I have to be honest. But in the early part of the season with Everton, he was allowing midfielders get beyond the ball. And Jamie Carragher was pointing this out and saying when he was over Liverpool, this was just a massive no-no. But he had loosened the reins a little bit.
Well, I think he realised possibly and arguably the strength of his team was the forward players and the attacking midfield players, Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison and Gray and Townsend and those kind of players. So he's a bright man, and he's a really good football man, and he's looked at it and thought, you know what, our strength is going forward, but if I pull them all back and get them all to try and defend, you know, what is the point? The injuries have done them in many, many ways, because you'd have to argue that the centre-forward would be the best player and the most effective, and without him, they've quite obviously struggled.
So the Liverpool team, again, for anyone joining us late, Alexander-Arnold, Matip, Van Dijk, Andy Robertson. The midfield three is Thiago, Fabinho and Jordan Henderson, and then it's Salah, Diogo Jota and Sadio Mane. I mean, a casual glance at their results suggests Liverpool are homing along nicely. What are you seeing?
Yeah, all good. They just had a little bit of a wobble. And it would be fair to say that Virgil van Dijk hasn't been in the best form of his life. He's still an absolutely outstanding player, but himself and Matip have had a couple of hiccups. Brighton at home, Brentford away. But obviously, they're still way up there. And I think Thiago back in the team. I absolutely love watching Thiago. He's just brilliant. I just wish he was 5 years younger. Because as a midfield player, he sees everything. He knows when people are around him. He seems to have built-in radar. His passing's sensational. His range of passing and his vision is excellent. And I think this is Liverpool's best three tonight. So that'd be Fabinho, Thiago and Henderson. I think this really, really works. But the problem with Thiago, unfortunately, because of his age, he keeps picking up injuries. But he's a great player.
Mm. Because people have questioned Thiago defensively, or questioned how quick he is to inject some tempo into play. Like, there's reservations there, but I take your point.
That's why Fabinho's playing.
Okay.
You know, that's why Fabinho's in the team, because he almost plays. Sometimes he's almost in the back two, you know, between Matip and Van Dijk. That's just the way that Fabinho plays. And, you know, it's all about the balance, isn't it? But, yeah. I mean, I was at the Porto game. I don't know if it was last week or the week before. And honestly, and I was commentating, I was stood up applauding Thiago. It was sensational. Forget about the goal, which was brilliant. Just the way, he just strutted around the game. Nobody could get anywhere near him. And Porto aren't a bad side either.
Mm. I couldn't work out, I watched it about 100 times, if his strike touched the ground or if it just had a kind of hovercraft quality.
I think it was a hovercraft one.
Yeah. I do as well, but it's so bloody rare you see one like that.
Yeah. But I mean, I was almost behind it, and he just, as soon as he struck it, and it never veered anywhere. It just went whoosh. No, I think it was he surprised himself as much as anyone, I think.
Yeah, it really was a thing of beauty. Will Jota keep his place when Firmino comes back?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because this fella, you know, goes under the radar a little bit because of Salah and because of Mane. He scores a lot of different goals as well, this lad. He seems to score a lot of headers. His movement's outstanding. And, you know, he'd be the first to say that, look, you know, playing that position is a little bit easier with Liverpool, A, because of the amount of chances, but also because you've got Mane on one side and Salah on the other, and they draw people over to them. So he's very, very clever at his runs, his timing of his runs, and he's very, very understated. I'm not even sure if I've ever seen him do an interview. He obviously has, but he just seems, it's a bit like when they signed him, nobody knew. Until they said, oh, by the way, Liverpool signed Jota for $40 million from Wolves. It was like, oh, where did that come from? And that's the way that he's been. Very, very understated, but he's an outstanding footballer.
Yeah. Look, Salah's been talked about a lot already this season. He's scored ridiculous goals. He's been in outrageous form, and I presume the contract negotiations are ongoing. How's Mane going for you?
Well, Mane, he wouldn't have had his best season. He's just started to pick up. But do you know something, Joe? He does a fabulous job for the team. You ask any fullbacks who play against him, he's one of those bony footballers. Ian Rush was just the same. And you go and try and tackle him, and you might be able to tackle him, but he'd catch you with his elbows and real strength. You think, flipping heck, what the hell was that? And he's game for anything. I mean, you saw him against Arsenal. He wanted to fight the right back, wanted to fight Arteta. I love a bit of that. That's all very, very good. But he's, in terms of his strength, He is a beast. And I'll tell you now, he's the nicest person in that football club. He never, ever, ever stops smiling or laughing when you talk to him.
Right, OK. Because, I mean, look, I've no feel for him. But, I mean, I remember him ignoring Jurgen Klopp on the pitch at Old Trafford and I wasn't so sure. So he's all good.
He gets a pin. I mean, I quite like that. Yeah. What you wrote me off for?
So he's one of the nice lads. Yeah?
Honestly, if you ask Matt McCann, who's the press officer there, and you say like who's the nicest of all these, when pushed, he'll tell you that it's Smarney.
Right, okay. Who else are the nice lads?
Well, most of them are nice lads, to be fair. In fact, I don't really like them because they're nearly all nice, and they need one or two nasties in there. I always feel, but they are, aren't they? I mean, look at Jordan Henderson, Van Dijk, all those lads.
Yeah.
You know,
Alexander-Arnold seems very. Head screwed on as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Is Robertson's form okay? I only ask, against West Ham he seemed to, well, a lot of his crosses didn't find Liverpool heads, and then I noticed he was on the bench subsequently. What's he been like more generally?
The thing is, they've got Tsimikas, haven't they? So and Tsimikas has done really, really well, but a big game it's Robertson.
Yeah.
And I think it's like anything, if Robbo basically played for 2 or 3 years generally unchallenged. And, you know, you know at some stage where you've got to buy someone to play left back, and you're just hoping that he's good. And Tsimikas is good, but not as good as Robertson. But he's good enough to play on a regular basis, say, in the league, etc. And I think it's a classic case. I always remember when we were there and me and Hansen, and we were playing every single game and all that kind of stuff, and they signed Gary Gillespie. And we both went, well, is it me or is it me? Like, you know, which one of us is going to make way? And I think, unluckily for Gary, we kind of kicked on, but it was the best thing that ever happened to us because it stopped us just being, you know, oh, we're playing every week. And all of a sudden you think, play badly this weekend and I'm out because Gary will play and maybe stay in the team.
Yeah. Well, listen, enjoy the game. Thanks a million for your time. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Mark Lawrenson there with us. And our football coverage is brought to you by Sky. You can watch Manchester United Arsenal tomorrow live only on Premier Sports.